Much. This afternoon, we're going to look at God's providence in nature, the forgotten doctrine, and the relationship between science and faith. Another way of talking about God's providence in nature might be God's activity in nature. The outline for our talk this afternoon will be the importance of God's providence, some definitions, creation compared to providence, wrestling with God's activity in nature, some things I've been wrestling with. And I want to propose a model for God's activity in nature that I've found helpful, and I hope you find helpful also. Some recommendations, as well as a summary of some of what we've learned this afternoon. So first of all, let's look at the importance of God's providence. God's providence is just another way of saying God's activity in the universe. Without God's continued activity, no created anything would exist, no math, no gravity, no light, no life. God's providence is the basis for science, and God's providence is the foundation for technology. And these will all be found in a standard Reformed systematic theology in case you're trying to recreate these somewhere. I certainly didn't write these. Okay, and from Grudem's systematic theology, he says that God has made and continues to sustain a universe that acts in predictable ways. If a scientific experiment gives a certain result today, then we can have confidence that if all the factors are the same, it will give the same result tomorrow and 100 years from tomorrow. I'm going to suggest some changes to this definition when we get into the wrestling part, so you might keep this in mind. Also, as the foundation for technology, Grudem continues, I can be confident that gasoline will make my car run today just as it did yesterday, not simply because it has always worked that way, but because God's providence sustains a universe in which created things maintain the properties in which He created them. Gasoline doesn't work because it's just gasoline. Gasoline works because in God's providence, what makes up gasoline works as gasoline. So let's look at some definitions. I want to define some classic definitions of creation as compared to providence. Creation. Creation in the strict sense of the word may be defined as that free act of God whereby He, according to His sovereign will and for His own glory in the beginning, brought forth the whole universe and invisible universe, whole visible and invisible universe, without the use of pre-existent material, and thus gave it an existence distinct from His own and yet always dependent on Him. I've underlined the word "in the beginning" because in this definition, that's the important thing to pick out of it. Another definition of creation, and both of these come from Birkhoff's Systematic Theology of 1941, creation is that act by which God produces the world and all that is in it, partly out of nothing and partly out of material that is by its very nature unfit for the manifestation of His glory, of His power, wisdom, and goodness. And I've underlined the part that says produces, i.e. in the present tense, because that's also part of God's creation, that He makes things in the current part. Now, I've trained as a geologist and worked for 6 years in the geologic field in education or as a petroleum geologist. And so I'm coming from the whole look at creation from a geologic perspective, i.e. a deep time, old, rocks have been around for a long time perspective. So when I say God produces the world, I'm thinking in terms of God has produced for a long time what we see in the world, not just what we see today. Let's change this to now providence. And I've got the equation E equals MC squared up there. Because in providence, God is continually involved with all the created things in such a way that He preserves. And then the other two pieces of providence are that He concurs or cooperates and that He governs. And so first of all, we'll look at preservation. God keeps all created things existing and maintaining, and He keeps those properties with which He created them. So God keeps all created things existing and maintaining the properties with which He created them. In this case, I put E equals MC squared up there because light, see, the properties of light, God has created those properties and He's maintained those properties since he created light. And so we'd expect those properties to be maintained in a stable, common type of existence that God had planned from the beginning. In other words, the speed of light is the speed of light is the speed of light, and doesn't necessarily change unless the properties of it have made it do that. Also put the periodic table up here. The same would be true here, that silicon has different properties than nitrogen, than oxygen, than iron, than zinc or titanium. And it's not just because those chemicals are different chemicals. It's because God has created and created that chemical, and he's given it specific properties that he's maintained for each of those chemicals. And that would be true with everything that he creates. God also cooperates with what he's created. He cooperates with created things in every action, directing their distinctive properties to cause them to act as they do. Another way of saying cooperation is concurrence. So in the case of this picture, we see a mountain goat. He's created that mountain goat, and he's given it distinctive properties that might be different than a goat that is on our farm, or a cow, or something else. It has distinctive properties, and God is directing those properties. That also be true with the tiger. God has made the cat as a cat, and he's directed that tiger with specific properties, and he's given it what you might term cattishness. Same with the deer. He's created that deer and given it distinctive properties to have it act the way it does. In this case, it's acting, it was alive, and now it's dead. So it's given it as a feeding the cat. And we'll look a little bit more about that subject when we get in the wrestling part of providence. Okay, thirdly, God governs with a purpose in all that he does in the world, and he providentially governs or directs all things in order to accomplish his purposes. I put a map of the world as it was during the Carboniferous. And during the Carboniferous, there were great coal forests around the earth, and God had planned to create coal forests and make coal out of that. And the power that we're using now may be from some of that coal that God created back then. And he had providentially governed and directed that from when he initially created that that coal forest that turned into coal. So God does the same thing in every part of his creation. In this case, I've got two hurricanes there. We'll read the same definition, but we'll think of a hurricane now instead of coal. God has a purpose in all that he does in the world, and he providentially governs and directs all things in order to accomplish his purposes. And we'll wrestle with that in a little bit, that these hurricanes are there as God has directed, as of anything in nature, that it's of God. A couple more things about providence that we need to look at as we're going through definitions before we wrestle with providence is what might be called ordinary providence, and that's when God works through a secondary cause in strict accordance with the laws of nature, although he may vary the results by different combinations. And that may be compared to what, and these come from Birkhoff in 1941, Systematic Theology. That might be compared to extraordinary providence, where he works immediately or without mediation of secondary causes in their ordinary operation. Birkhoff calls these miracles. In other words, God works without recourse to the ordinary means of production. Now, miracle is defined a little different in Strong's 1907 theology, and this is actually from Birkhoff. I think Birkhoff or Grudem says it a little better, but it's the same idea, that a miracle is a less common kind of God's activity in which he arouses people's awe and wonder and bears witness to himself. Notice that in this definition of a miracle, it doesn't have to do with changing nature, and it doesn't have to do with breaking in and breaking some natural law. It has to do with God having a different kind of activity that creates awe and wonder, whereas an extraordinary providence, he's coming in and doing something different in nature that we might not ordinarily see. So there's a little bit of difference in the theologians about how they look at extraordinary providence and miracles, but we'll be mostly looking in science. We study ordinary providence anyway. Okay, just some examples of secondary causes. I'll just kind of get a drink here while you read through these. Plate tectonics, wind and waves, climate change, competition, change in predation, genetic changes, basically anything in nature. Okay, so let's wrestle a little bit with God's activity in nature. Okay, wrestle number one, challenges with providence. In reading about divine providence, one of the challenges that people have is with human freedom. Nature, free will agents, and agencies that cause causation. Another wrestling with providence is determinism seems to make the God the author of sin and nullifies human agency. Another challenge is the problem of evil, which when I put the hurricanes up there, a lot of us squirm because, oh my goodness, that seems evil. Well, it is. It's a challenge with the problem of evil. And then there's a challenge with God's use of power. Does he use it in control or in love? And there's an open model criticism of that. And there's also a fifth challenge of what is meant by a secondary cause. I'm proposing that the first three in an ancient nature don't need to be discussed because as a geologist, I'm concerned about what was around before people were even here. The fall happened with people. And so I'm not worried about the first three because there were no people around on what I study. So I'm just worried about God's use of power and what is meant by secondary cause. And so I probably could have titled this God's Providence in Ancient Nature a little better, but we'll keep it the way it is, God's Providence in Nature. Okay, the second thing I want to wrestle with a little bit is what do church people read? In order to prepare for the talk, I went to the local bookstore and asked a couple questions. What do I find in the theology section that's related to creation and providence? And about 30% of the books in the theology section had a discussion of creation and or providence. And some of those immediately came off the list because they didn't discuss providence. And what was interesting to me is those were dispensational theologies. And I need to do some more study of that because I was really surprised that dispensational theology didn't have any section in there on providence. And maybe I'm just reading the wrong books. And my daughter goes to Moody, so I need to have her do a little research and find out what are we teaching at Moody about providence. I'll be interested. I just want to learn some more about that. And then I asked the question, okay, because I'm taking off those first three, which of these books discuss providence in people's lives, because part of providence is what do you do when a child dies? And how does God's providence help me with that? For example, the Invisible Hand by R.C. Sproul all talks about disasters in people's lives and how do we deal with them. That's not part of the topic I'm looking at as a geologist, because remember, people aren't around. It doesn't matter. So when I take that out of the question, I come down to about half those books. So about 15% or half of 30% of my books in the theology section are books that are useful to me for talking about God's providence in nature or just wrestling with God's activity in nature. A third item I'm wrestling with is the whole creation versus evolution debate. And notice the arrows are going both ways, not really ability to communicate. And I have a hypothesis in that it's because it's related to providence. Because without God's providence, creationists have no ongoing mechanism to explain a tightly knit relationship between God and nature. They resort to explaining any change in nature to God's direct creative handiwork and cannot model God's involvement otherwise. And without God's providence, evolutionists have no mechanism to tie what they observe in nature to the person of God. Thus, they run the risk of appearing to support worldviews that do not include a personal, active, involved God. And so, perhaps a consequence of ignoring providence is an inability to talk to each other about the nature of creation and evolution. And maybe that's helped create some of the debate. Okay, a fourth thing to wrestle with is the classical views of God's providence that stands midway between the extremes of pantheism and deism, or theism. Pantheism would be the denial that God is separate from nature. So if I have a circle, God and nature are within that circle. And materialism would be denial that there is a primary cause in nature, i.e. God. And deism would say the same thing, even though God is there, God is not active in nature. So it comes out to be about the same when it comes down to asking the question, how active is God in nature? So let's just look at the theist issue and just pull out the theism piece and ask the question, just how active is God in nature, and ask about what some of the literature is concerned about, just theism. One of the concerns in literature is that if I'm too active, if I say God is very active in nature within a theist model, then I get to be too pantheist. And I don't want to be pantheist because that removes the person of God, and that's a scary thing. On the other hand, if I say that God is not active in nature, that he's delegated everything to other things, then I run the risk of becoming too deistic. And so I have a trouble with the idea that, well, gee, I got theism squeezed between deism and pantheism. And so what I want to propose is an active, distinct model of God's providence in which I have two axes, one where we describe God as either distinct or indistinct from nature, or another one where God is personally active or irrelevant. And in the case of theism, God is active and distinct. In the case of deism, God is his own person or distinct and inactive because he wound up the clock of the world and the world goes on without him. In materialism, he's irrelevant and so therefore he's indistinct. And in pantheism, he's so personally active that he's part of it. Okay, so here we have a nice four quadrant, and let's see what we can do with this quadrant and see if it solves some of our problems. And again, we're just going to look at the theism piece because that's all we're concerned about. So theism, put deism below it, and put a nice line where we say God is very hands-on, God is hands-off, and we say their models of hands-on would emphasize God's personal activity in nature, whereas God's where models of hand where God is hands-off, they would emphasize God's delegation in nature. Maybe we'll even put a grid on this, okay, just for fun, okay? And that way, the nice thing about this is it creates a debate from a theistic worldview that's not squeezed between pantheism and deism, i.e., which goes right on back down to atheist and materialism. So it takes that fear away. And it also allows inclusion of evolution as a secondary cause without fear of going clear on down to atheistic materialism. Because as I move down here to delegating to nature down to here, there's a fear in the church that if I keep going, I'll get to atheistic materialism. Remember my model up here. If I keep going from theism, I eventually get to materialism. And I don't have that problem with this because as I come down, materialism's over here, it's not even in the question. I do get to deism, but frankly, I believe one of the problems in the church today is a lot of us are deistic on Monday and theistic on Sunday, but that's a whole other question. So it allows us to have a discussion and a debate about how active is God in nature without a fear of going materialistic or pantheistic. All we have left is worrying about deistic, which is a good thing to talk about among those of us that are theists. So how do we train ourselves to think of a higher number? When I first start meeting with my friend Ken Wagemuth back in the early 90s, I asked him this question, and I said, gee, what number are you? For example, if I drop this pen, does God's fingers lower that pen every way along the way? In other words, does God's hand lower that with gravity? And he looked at me askance and went, oh my goodness, that's a horrible idea. Because he was seeing God as hands off. And I was seeing God as hands on. And I think that's a useful dialogue in the church to talk about, because Scripture is full of references to God does this in nature. God does that in nature. God does something else in nature. And I don't read those figuratively. I read those literally, that God is actually doing that in nature because I see a hands-on God. So what number do you assume? Hold up some fingers. Hold up fingers. Everybody's going to have different fingers in here. Yeah. So those of us that are a 2 versus a 10 versus a 5, we have a very different view of God in nature, and that's going to create a very different conversation about how we approach conversation of creation, evolution, and what God's doing in nature. And I think that's important to acknowledge. And if we use this model, it gives us the ability to do that. So here's some recommendations. Look at the model. Look at our personal view. Think about what's going on in nature around it. Every time you drop a pen, I want you to remember what I did here. When I drop a pen, I think about God's hand lowering that pen to the floor. Think about that in terms of everything you see around you, that God's hand is doing it. I think we could provide resources to the public that focus on changes in nature as tied to God's sovereign, personal, active relationship to that change. And to stop thinking in terms of creation versus evolution, begin thinking about God's providence. I suggest to change some wording, and it's kind of dangerous to suggest to an eminent theologian, but he's a good friend, to change some wording, and I might. So I might write a letter to Dr. Grudem and see if he'd be willing to consider this language in his systematic theology, because it would help me as a geologist say that carbon has not had a different quality since carbon was created. It's been carbon. And in other words, his definition assumes that it's kind of like now on forward. And I need a definition of providence that takes me back a long time, an old-time kind of perspective. Scripture is full of language attributing directly to God's activity what happens in nature. Providence allows us to read these literally. For example, he touches the mountains and they smoke. I like to think of God actually touching that mountain and it smoking. Because under his providence, under his preservation, under his cooperation, and under his governance, he is touching that mountain, because everything that makes that mountain smoke is under his direction. Now we get into a trickier area, because here's Katrina coming into New Orleans. And we may accept natural disasters that happen as, yes, being governed by God, but knowing that human agency due to the fall actually makes them disasters. Otherwise, they'd be events. Even the wind and the waves obey him. In Luke 8:22-25, Jesus was doing what as God he has done since time began. Now, as a geologist, that's exciting, because what I study in geology is what the results from the wind and the waves. So when I look at Luke 8, I'm looking at the cause of what I study in the rocks. Jesus, director of the wind and the waves, creates those rocks that I'm studying in geology. There's nothing wrong or evil about ecosystems that God has created and for whom he is providing, letting our feelings for the deer aside. And I frankly think some of those feelings come from just a real sensitivity, and some of them come from Disney. And this is Psalm 104:21 in action. And I don't want to say that lightly, because a lot of us are really sensitive, and I think that's a God-given thing. So when I pick up a fossil, I look at God having created that plant or animal, and I praise God for the relationship he had with it and the ecosystem in which it lived. So to summarize, the doctrine of creation itself is inadequate for theological ties to scientific or technological work, as it doesn't model God's activity in nature. The doctrine of evolution itself is inadequate due to the danger of ignoring God's activity. And using an active, distinct model for God's providence is useful to help one see God as highly active, but not trend toward either pantheism or materialism. And as for our part in Solid Rock Lectures, we'll work to provide creation workshops to Bible schools, seminaries, and churches, and we will include a discussion of God's providence in our presentations of Old Earth Geology. Thank you. At the back there.
Just a comment. I can only say preach it. I think you're exactly right. I've been trying to do this for a decade in the ASA. Welcome all the partners.
Well, thank you.
What I have observed, and you know, you sort of hinted at it, is if you use this setup for people as a sort of a precursor to the origins debate, creation evolution debate.
Yes, which is what we do.
It changes the whole.
Yes, it does.
I've done it in Christian school classes.
Thank you.
And in adult education classes, and you know, seeing God at work in creation and providence is an easily established biblical idea, and then to move to all aspects of science from there is an easy move. Now, that doesn't mean that they're instantly converted those ideas, but it really takes the sharp edge off of a lot of the debates.
Thank you. Randy?
Yeah, in your little model there of the theism, deism, materialism, and, you know,
anyway.
How would you position Arthur Peacock's panentheism?
Panentheism.
And why would you not consider that as a viable alternative?
Because it makes it complicated?
Yeah.
I'm trying to talk to the guy in the church pew, probably. I think at a Sunday school level. I figure if you can't communicate at a Sunday school level, then you're not going to win the world, which is why I go to the Christian bookstore and see what's there, not necessarily what's in the literature.
You're saying that kind of removes your criticism of pantheism, you know.
Yeah, it would.
Because he makes a distinction between you know, he kind of presents another possibility.
Yeah, let me think about that, because this is always changing. That's a great idea. No, I've got transcendence on the right up here, distinct from nature.
Yeah, but it's still not the distinction, which is how we rule out pantheism. So it's something in the middle.
Yeah. I'll have to look at that. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
The critique of panentheism is similar.
Pardon? Sorry. Way down here.
Yeah, that one.
Sorry.